everyone, it's Colin. How's it going? So we all know just how common x86-based CPUs are. I mean, ever since their launch by Intel in the late 70s, we've seen dramatic performance improvements on a regular basis. They're in practically every desktop and laptop and server. But for the last decade or so, we've seen the performance improvements slow down fairly quickly. And it's caused a lot of people to say that Intel is just totally screwed. Well, but is it? And where are we going from a technology perspective? So, I mean, obviously x86 is not just a common, but also popular chip architecture. And even though Intel pioneered it over 40 years ago, they're not the only ones working on it. There have been others who have licensed it and made their own chips. I mean, AMD is kind of the most obvious example. They've been around for a very long time, but there have been some others too that have either not lasted or haven't been as popular, like Xerox. Intel has traditionally been the primary driver behind advancements to the x86 lineup, like when it moved to the 32-bit architecture for its CPUs in 1985, and then continuing to shrink the process size, you know, the size of the transistors on the chips, on a really regular basis, generally. But AMD has had its own fair share of contributions to the platform, like its 64-bit implementation that it started rolling out kind of around 2003. And this is actually the one that we still use today, even in Intel 64-bit CPUs. Intel had actually tried its own version of 64-bit processing in about 1998 with a few series of CPUs, the most popular one being Itanium. And it co-developed that whole platform alongside Hewlett-Packard. But it was targeted primarily at servers and like really powerful workstations. Because of how different of an architecture it ended up being, even though there was some backwards compatibility, it really needed a different operating system to be recompiled to run on it. Like, you couldn't just necessarily throw a standard 32-bit copy of Windows on there. You needed one that was platform specific. And that kind of extended to the applications that would run on top of like Itanium as well. Now, if you compare that to something like the AMD 64 architecture, which if you've ever installed Linux, you've probably seen those options. Like when you're downloading media or selecting what to install, you've got the option of x86 or AMD 64. Why is it AMD 64? Well, because AMD actually designed it. And in the case of AMD 64, yes, you still needed to have the OS and any applications compiled specifically to run on it, but you only needed to do that in order to take advantage of the full performance and memory space that those chips could offer. If you didn't need those or didn't have software that was compatible with it yet, you could still install and run an x86-based operating system and applications, and generally they'd work fine. I mean, we still do that to this day. I mean, think of how many applications you still run in Windows that are like 32-bit on a 64-bit based system, like pretty much all of us are running now, they work fine. And if you've got really old applications or really old drivers or something like that, in some cases, you can just install an x86, like 32-bit version of Windows. And yes, there is a 32-bit version of Windows 10. You can install it on a modern CPU and it operates just fine. So Itanium, what it ended up doing was carving out a small niche in some enterprise environments, places like banks, for use on their servers and like central, you know, transaction processing. But it didn't really get very far just because of kind of the roadblocks it faced to adoption. You know, these places couldn't necessarily just run their existing code on these new chips and suddenly, oh, they're a whole lot faster. So it kind of flailed around and never really took off. There were some places that adopted it, and we'll talk about what ended up with them in a little bit. But let's just say Intel ultimately gave up on Itanium. And the final version of those CPUs, like the last ones that Intel would ever release, those came out in 2017, and Intel has said the official discontinuation of the entire Itanium platform is going to happen in July 2021. Microsoft has already pretty much ended support for Itanium a few years ago, so you can't really expect any new versions of Windows coming out, like Windows Server, to support Itanium CPUs like they used to. Now, x86, and I'm using the term x86 just to mean kind of Intel and AMD-based chips, regardless of whether they're 32 or 64-bit. But x86, it hasn't actually always been at the top of the heap when it comes to performance. A lot of people always have it in this mind of, well, the Intel and AMD chips, x86 is like the fastest thing you can get, and everything underneath it is just cheap and slow, low performance. Well, there's actually been a lot of changes over the years as to which chips are fastest, and it's kind of come and gone as architectures have come out and matured and changed. It's actually, the whole x86 platform is actually kind of like lost and regained the title of like fastest consumer-focused CPUs several times over the years. In the early 80s, chips like the Motorola 68000 were seen as high-end. Some companies really wanted to go that route because those were what was leading the performance at the time compared to what Intel had available. And again, in the early 90s, PowerPC chips were considered really robust competition. Now, PowerPC was a joint project between Apple, IBM, and Motorola. At the time, Apple needed something faster than the 68000 series of chips, which, you know, over the course of about 10 years had kind of reached their architectural limitations. Motorola couldn't really push them any further and didn't have a way to iterate beyond them. IBM was interested because it wanted an option that would reduce its reliance on Intel. And Motorola simply wanted new chips to manufacture so they could keep making money. Now, the story goes way deeper than that, and I'm going to save a deeper explanation for a future YouTube episode. So don't worry, it's a really interesting story. But by the late 90s and into the early 2000s, with the advancements to PowerPC and what Intel had been doing and AMD with x86, we actually started seeing PowerPC outperforming x86. And we also started to see PowerPC kind of proliferate and end up in embedded devices because at that time, PowerPC was simply more efficient in terms of power, in terms of heat, in terms of performance, and in some cases, in terms of cost. But as we've seen with other chips kind of coming and going, by around the mid-2000s, PowerPC started running out of steam. I mean, the engineers designing it couldn't really increase performance without also dramatically increasing power consumption as well as heat. And that's a bad sign. I mean, Apple's PowerMac G5 computers, they came from the factory with water cooling by the end of their lifespan. And Apple was, in fact, never able to make a PowerPC G5-based laptop. They simply ran too hot and drew too much power. No one would want to buy a laptop like that. And so around that time, Intel had kind of caught up and, in a way, even succeeded PowerPC. It coincided with the launch of its Core series of CPUs, the Core Duo and Core Solo. And those were just dramatically faster, even though they used a less efficient architecture than PowerPC. And we'll get more to architecture in a bit. That's when the trajectory that we've been on now really kind of started. I mean, going into the Pentium series, the Pentium 2, Pentium 3, there were very solid increases in performance then. They were sometimes lagging behind PowerPC, but not a whole lot. Pentium 4 was a bit of a setback for Intel around the early 2000s. It was so much of a setback that Intel kind of had to go back to the drawing board. And it actually revisited the Pentium 3 and some of its laptop chip derivatives in coming up with the Core series of chips. Pentium 4 was actually kind of a dead end for the series for Intel. It kind of painted itself into a corner, I guess you could say, with those chips. So the chips that we know now are actually really just kind of like the grandchildren of the Pentium 3. And Intel managed to figure out ways to continue to improve those chips on a fairly regular basis. They've managed to shrink the process size down at a fairly regular pace, at least for a while. Obviously, they added 64-bit support. And what the trend we've been seeing lately is this proliferation of cores and threads within the CPU die. I mean, it's no longer where you think of a CPU as just one processing core and it only does its one thing. Now a CPU is really just kind of a combination of multiple elements all working together to crunch numbers. And with the launch of that CPU series, it's really cemented, at least for a long time, Intel and AMD, you know, the whole x86 platform as being just the de facto standard for computing. And I mean like desktops and laptops and servers. In fact, I don't think there's really been a consumer PC sold in the last 5 years that's had an Intel CPU with only one core. I mean, that's really kind of how far we've come with it in terms of the advancement. So what's changed? What's going on now? Why are people saying that Intel is in trouble and what's on the horizon? Well, so Intel is now kind of in some ways in the same position that PowerPC was about 15 years ago. It's really just running out of places to go with the platform. It struggled to adopt smaller lithographies. Most of its CPUs are still 14 nanometer, which it's been on for several years, and it's only adopted 10 nanometer, which is like the next step down, to a very small scale. Yearly improvements have been overall pretty small, nowhere near what we had seen like in the late 2000s, early 2010s. And single core performance hasn't really improved a whole lot with each generation of CPUs. Intel does seem to stick to about a yearly cycle for releasing new CPUs, but it's really fallen off of its pattern of every 2 years developing something that's a dramatic improvement than the generation before. I mean, that was kind of what they were on for a long time. They called it the tick-tock cycle, where, you know, 1 year they would introduce CPUs on a brand new process, basically the next kind of step down in terms of transistor size. And then the year after that, they would take those chips and optimize them for even better performance before doing it again. They've fallen off of that pattern years ago. And now it's kind of like, who knows what they're going to be able to do with each year's improvements. So to produce faster processors, to actually get at least some changes going on, Intel has had to do a few things. First is a dramatic expansion of cores in its CPUs. Like I was saying, you know, it used to be where you would think of a CPU and it would just be one core. It would be one unit. And if you had something that was multiprocessor, you literally had more than one CPU in your computer. And that was very rare. For the longest time, multiprocessing was generally just a server-only thing. You needed to have special software that could take advantage of it, and relatively little software did. But as performance needed to increase, we couldn't just keep cranking up the speed on CPUs. We needed to start kind of growing outwards and getting more parallel processing going on. So multiprocessing started coming to the masses around the early 2000s with, you know, the Pentium. There were like some dual core Pentiums right before the Core series came out. The Core series, of course, the Core 2 Duo was a very, very popular line of chips. And now we're into the Core I series. And for a long time, even after the Core series came out, it used to be that like two cores was the standard for a consumer CPU. And you'd get four cores only in like the enthusiast or gamer kind of oriented CPUs. Anything beyond four cores, that was pretty much just the realm only for servers. They were super expensive. Now, like in the last 2 to 3 years, we're seeing relatively inexpensive computers that are coming with four cores standard. And you can even get like laptops with 6 or 8 core CPUs. Now, a quick kind of side note about AMD. It hasn't been like sitting, you know, off by itself doing nothing this entire time. Although it did lag behind Intel for a number of years, it's done way better lately. Its newer CPU architectures are actually putting Intel's chips to shame. Yet that still doesn't mean that AMD isn't and won't keep facing the same challenges that Intel is. Yeah, they've managed to show solid single core benchmarks, but that's largely because they've gotten smaller lithographies to work out for them. They've done a better job at getting that to work, making CPU transistors smaller than Intel has. And it's not necessarily because of like fundamental architecture changes that have been improving efficiency. They're just able to pack more transistors onto the die. And that's how you make computers go faster, at least one way that you can. There are, however, limits on how small the transistors on CPUs can be. And so AMD is going to hit those limits just like everybody else. AMD's overall solid CPU results that we're seeing these days are mostly because they just keep throwing more cores at the problem. For example, you can buy consumer-focused CPUs from AMD that have like 32 cores on them. They're not cheap, but they're not ridiculously expensive either. And that really just goes to show kind of where some of the future of computing is going. AMD is just like, you know what, let's just pack as much as we possibly can into a single chip. And yeah, the chips themselves are physically pretty big to match, but they're just kind of spreading out the workload across as many CPUs as they can fit and get working together. Another way that both Intel and AMD together have tried to improve performance is through some creative use of, like, let's say, co-processing or caching or other like trickery, I guess. I think the most straightforward and simple example of this is Intel's QuickSync feature, which is basically just hardware accelerated video transcoding that's built right into the CPU. So instead of the CPU having to spend its like general processing cycles compressing or decompressing video like H.264 or now H.265, it's able to offload that onto a dedicated part of the chip that's designed specifically for doing that. If that part of the chip was not integrated into the CPU, if it was like a separate chip on the motherboard, we'd normally call that an ASIC or application-specific integrated circuit. It's where you make hardware that's designed to do one thing and do it really well and do it really efficiently. And there's other use cases for ASICs out there. It's actually fairly common in technology, but you don't see it fairly tailored like that in a consumer, you know, a consumer focus. It can be expensive to design specific chips to do specific tasks like that. So it's generally more like industrial kind of stuff, like high-end networking equipment that enterprises use. A lot of times the traffic, the network traffic that flows through routers and switches will flow through an ASIC just because it's so much more efficient to do so. It's costly to design a chip to do something like that, but, you know, industry can afford it. So QuickSync is a really great example of kind of taking that technology and bringing it down to the consumer masses. The benefit of it is not only does that get you better like battery life if it's a laptop or cooler temperatures within the CPU, simply because now you've got this very efficient component of the CPU doing all that heavy lifting, but it also takes that load off of the general processing of the CPU itself. So if you need to do anything else alongside that video transcoding, like in our example, well, the CPU is just going to feel like it's running faster. Another example is something like speculative execution. Think of it this way. As computers run, there's times when the CPU is crunching numbers, and there's times when the CPU is waiting for software to tell it what numbers to crunch. It's waiting for the system to tell it to do something. Now, if a chip has been getting repetitive requests, there's a few ways that it can help kind of speed up processing. If it keeps getting asked the same thing over and over, that's where things like cache can play a part, where, like, if you ask a CPU, hey, what's 1+1? Hey, what's 1+1? It's not going to sit there and crunch the number of what 1+1 is every single time you do it. It's going to store that in cache. So the next time you ask the CPU, hey, what's 1+1? It doesn't have to do the math. It'll just go, oh, you've already asked me that before, 2. Right? That's a very simple example, but that's really kind of the point of cache. It's for identical repetitive requests. What if the requests are similar or go down kind of a known process of logic? You know, like, hey, I'm going to ask this question. The answer could be this, or the answer could be this other thing, or it could be one of three possible solutions or something like that, just based on how the question gets asked. Well, that's where something like speculative execution comes into play. And granted, this is a very simplistic explanation of it. Computer and CPU science is just this mind-bogglingly complex topic. And I'll freely admit, I'm definitely no expert in the super deep, low-level workings of all of it. But here's the way I like to think of speculative execution. It's where the CPU can kind of anticipate what computational tasks a piece of software may ask of it ahead of time, before the software asks of it. And during that downtime, during that period where it's waiting for the software to tell it what to do, it just goes ahead and crunches the numbers anyway, right? If this, and going back to our simple 1+1 example, you know, what if the CPU thinks, okay, the software is going to ask me what's 1+1, or it could ask me what's 1+2. It also could ask me what's 1+3. Well, if it's sitting there waiting, that's wasted time. That's wasted execution cycles it could be doing useful work in. So speculative execution would have the CPU actually just crunching all those numbers while it's waiting. And it'll just be sitting there in the cache waiting for the software to ask. So if the software comes back and goes, hey, yeah, what's 1+3? The CPU is like, oh, 4. I already know it. Boom. And now your software acts like it's a lot faster. It doesn't necessarily mean the CPU itself is computing anything faster, but it's doing that work ahead of time so the net effect is faster performance. Now, features like this and some others, by the way, are largely what's been the cause of a lot of the processor vulnerabilities you may have heard about in the past few years. Things like Spectre and Meltdown, they keep coming out because Intel and AMD, even though Intel has seen a bigger share of these vulnerabilities, they've been pushed so hard to improve performance, they haven't necessarily been able to work out all the security ramifications. Or perhaps if you're of the more kind of nefarious and skeptical kind of mindset, they've ignored the security ramifications because they want the business impact of being able to push out faster CPUs. I think the truth is kind of a combination of all of that. But anyway, so while x86 chips are, as we said, by far the most common things in like laptops, desktop servers, we are going to see a dramatic shift in the next couple of years. And I think it's going to come sooner rather than later. That, of course, is the ARM platform. Smartphones, tablets, they've been using ARM-based processors for years. In fact, ARM has been around since like 1985. Embedded devices have rapidly adopted it as well over the last decade or so. A lot of the devices that moved to PowerPC back when that seemed like it was the faster, more efficient, less expensive solution, those are now moving to ARM. The reason why is simply because, I guess you could just say, it's the future of CPUs. It's dramatically more efficient than x86. And the primary reason why it's more efficient comes down to just the way it works. This is where we get into the discussion about RISC versus CISC CPUs. It all stems back to when computers were relatively new and memory, and we're talking like RAM and to some extent storage, was scarce and expensive, right? When you run a program, a portion of that program needs to go into memory, usually RAM, simply because that is the fastest place that you can store data. Could you imagine how slow a computer would be if it had to read literally everything off of the hard drive? It'd be so slow it was unusable. So back in the day, memory was limited because it was expensive. It was physically expensive to manufacture and buy and put in a computer. This is back in the days when like 128 kilobytes of RAM was considered a lot. And of course, now that's literally nothing in the scope of computing. 128 kilobytes, like what? Like that's nothing now. Back then that was a big deal. So when you wrote programs, you needed the programs to be as efficient in their code as you possibly could get in order to take up as little space in memory as possible, either so that you could get the entire program into memory if it was loading off of something like a cassette tape, which yes, programs used to load off of cassette tapes way, way, way back when, or later on, like off of a floppy disk or a hard drive, to reduce how often you would have to hit those relatively slow formats. You wanted to fit as much of the program as you could into RAM. So you tried to write your program to be very efficient. Now, hardware manufacturers, in this case, Intel, with its x86 lineup, it adopted this methodology called CISC, or Complex Instruction Set Computing. The simplest way to describe this is that the CPU has a lot of different things that it could do. There's a lot of different ways that it can crunch numbers. And because it offers this broad suite of ways of crunching numbers and dealing with data, that allows software developers to write more efficient programs. They can do more work with fewer steps because the CPU understands what they're asking for, right? So instead of, say, you know, like you need to transform data in a certain way, instead of needing to take like 8 lines of code to do it, like you do step A with the data, then you take it and do step B, and then you do step C, and then you end up with the result, you know, at step D, the CPU understands all four of those steps because maybe that's an instruction that's built into it. So the software can do everything in like one line. Well, going from 8 lines of code down to 1 line of code, that's an improvement on how much memory gets used. So you can, again, get your programs to fit better into memory and run faster from that perspective. The problem is the CPU now has this broad set of instructions that it needs to support, and that slows it down because it's got just this wide variety of things it has to do. Reduced instruction set computing, RISC, is where the future is headed, but we've also been there before. That's what PowerPC was based on, along with a number of other CPU architectures over the time. And RISC basically means limiting how many different types of computational tasks a CPU can perform and putting that back on the software to tell the CPU what you want it to do, instead of like having the CPU kind of know, oh, I'll just do that for you. The net benefit is RISC CPUs are generally more efficient because they're able to streamline tasks. Think of it this way. The example that I like to use when explaining this is, think of it as like a chef in a kitchen. You've got one restaurant that has this big, broad menu a wide variety of things that you can order off the menu, you know, sandwiches and pizza and wings and different ethnicities of food, all just this, anything you can think of, it's on the menu. The poor chef back in the kitchen has to know how to make all of that stuff. But they also have to have all of those ingredients handy and all the different tools to cook the food, plus some types of food may be more labor intensive to make than others. So if you've got a restaurant full of people all ordering a wide variety of things, that poor chef is back there working their tail off, trying to like scrambling around the kitchen. You know, I'm seeing like in my mind, like, you know, pots and pans flying everywhere and just like, you know, arms flailing and just, you know, just craziness, because this poor person is like, just got to do way too much in the amount of time that they have to do it. Whereas a restaurant that like used a risk kind of mentality would be like a pizza joint, right? Where it's a limited menu. All they make is pizza and maybe one other thing. Well, that's a lot easier because you can even just assembly line that thing, right? Like if everybody's ordering a pizza, the only difference between them is what toppings you put on there, that sort of thing. That's way, way faster, more efficient to do. So some of the latest ARM-based CPUs have actually gotten so advanced because they're using this risk-based methodology that they can not only meet, but also beat the performance of consumer Intel CPUs. For example, the latest iPhones are actually faster than some of Apple's own MacBook laptops. Think about the difference in form factor there, right? The phone is a sealed enclosure with no fan or elaborate heatsink, and it runs exclusively off of a battery. Whereas a laptop has a heatsink, it has a fan, it has a much bigger battery, and it still produces more heat with the air coming out of that fan than you feel in your hand with that phone when you hold it. And the phone is faster. That's a pretty dramatic improvement. So with such a massive improvement in efficiency, it's really no surprise that like Apple is expected to announce very soon. This is kind of the big news as I'm recording this. Very soon, Apple is going to announce that it's actually going to switch away from Intel CPUs in its computers to ones based on ARM processors. Other companies have actually tried this too. Microsoft did a few years ago with its Surface RT tablet. And we've seen a few Chromebooks here and there over the years also come with ARM-based processors. Now, Windows RT, that whole debacle, exemplifies why the transition for the computer industry as a whole won't be ridiculously quick. It won't just be like suddenly the new laptops for 2021 are all going to be based on ARM CPUs. And it primarily comes down to legacy software. There's generally been this hesitation to cut off support for older software. And it just goes back years and years and years. And, you know, it's kind of understandable, right? Windows and x86, that's a huge market. And beyond the consumer audience, who is somewhat sensitive to legacy support for software, because they can't always go out and get the latest and greatest version of software, especially when it's stuff you have to pay for. There's also a lot, an awful lot of custom software that's been written for companies and government that would be very expensive and time consuming to rewrite for another platform. And that's really kind of what tanked Windows RT. It could only run apps compiled for ARM. So users were really limited in what they could do with the devices. I mean, it ended up kind of being a catch-22 where the software developers weren't willing to rewrite their software, recompile it for ARM-based systems until the demand was there. But the demand would never show up because there weren't any programs for people to run. Now, lately, there's been a renewed push to try again, this time with the recognition that being able to run x86 software in emulation on ARM hardware is just gonna be necessary. There's no way around it. That's almost guaranteed what Apple is going to do as part of its own transition, the one that's upcoming where it goes to ARM CPUs on its Macs. And the reason I say that is because it's something they've already done twice before. The first time was when they went from the Motorola 68000 chips to PowerPC. They did software emulation for those. And then again, from PowerPC to Intel. You could run your older Mac PowerPC apps on your new Intel-based Mac, at least for a few years before they really push developers, hey, get with the times. Now, alongside that, businesses and the server industry are also finally starting to at least take ARM seriously, starting to experiment with it, really kind of get their feet wet, though it hasn't expanded all that rapidly. Obviously, in a server environment, power consumption and heat are the biggest concerns, especially with the really large data centers. So companies like big cloud providers are the ones who are really the most interested in running ARM CPUs on servers. For example, Amazon AWS and Cloudflare, amongst a few others, are now deploying ARM-based servers. Though they're not doing so extensively just yet, and you can't necessarily do a whole lot with them if you're a customer of those companies, like for hosting or whatever. In general, they're being used for specific tasks like serving up web pages. But they are reaping some pretty big benefits from doing so. Now, another big change that comes with ARM processors is actually how the CPUs are designed and made, right? Like with Intel and AMD, they did everything themselves, right? They're vertically integrated. Intel and AMD would design the CPUs, they would manufacture them, they would work with the vendors who manufacture computers to make chipsets available and sell all of this as a package to them. And then kind of on top of that, those two companies work with companies like Microsoft to make sure that Windows is optimized for the latest CPUs and all that sort of thing. They kind of control the entire stack themselves. ARM is different. While ARM, the company, does like the low-level architectural work of improving the CPUs, you know, coming out with new designs, adding new features, that sort of thing, ARM will actually license out those designs to other companies to build off of or customize or manufacture. So, for example, Qualcomm's Snapdragon processors, Samsung's Exynos, Apple's A-series chips. Those are all based on ARM, but they've been customized and manufactured by each of those companies. Now, this can benefit those companies since they can prioritize what's most important for their own uses in those chips, or optimize how their hardware and software work together. The best example of this, again, is Apple. This is why iOS devices are generally considered so incredibly efficient, really good battery life, really, really good performance. There are, however, some caveats and a few concerns I have, though. And this is where we need to start thinking of this in a new way, right? This hasn't really been a concern before. Years ago, yeah, ARM was this really cool thing. It's totally taking over, like, tablets and smartphones and all that. It's a great use for those platforms, but Intel still offered, and AMD still really offered, like, raw performance for your desktop or your gaming PC or whatever. But if ARM CPUs are going to start picking up in the consumer space for PCs, we need to start thinking about some of these concerns. The first one that comes to mind for me is compatibility. Just because they're all based on an ARM design doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to be perfectly cross-compatible, right? So in the case of a phone or a tablet, it probably doesn't matter, right? You're just going to run the OS on it that it came with, right? If you buy an Android phone, you're going to run Android on it, that sort of thing. But when general computing, desktops, laptops, servers, start to switch in earnest, my fear is that it's going to make those computers less flexible. For example, right now with an x86-based PC, you can install a variety of operating systems. You can install Windows. You can install just like there's a ton of different Linux distros out there. You could even install macOS on a lot of them if you're willing to put work in it. And that's because the standards for x86-based chips require that they be kind of cross-compatible. It doesn't matter if you have an i3 or an i5 or something from AMD. At their core, you know, they can all run the same software kind of in the same way. With ARM, though, will the companies that make those chips for desktops and laptops design them in such a way that they're at least somewhat compatible with each other, like it is between AMD and Intel? Or are they going to align more tightly with PC hardware and software manufacturers to produce more lockdown devices? Right? So imagine Samsung decides to manufacture a new laptop with an Exynos-based CPU. Are they going to just partner with Microsoft to offer an Exynos customized version of Windows? Like, what's the Linux community going to be able to do? Would they have to then spin their own version? Would they have to then do all sorts of reverse engineering and everything to figure out what is special about Exynos in order to perform on it? Or, like, what's going to happen? Are we going to see further lockdowns where, like, even if you had a version of Linux that was customized for that version of ARM chip, you couldn't run on it because they've locked it down so you could only run the target operating system, Windows or whatever, right? This is probably what's going to happen with Apple and ARM-based Macs, is you will only be able to run the Mac OS. Being able to boot camp into Windows, even if Microsoft came out with a version of Windows optimized for Apple's version of ARM-based chips, whatever form they take when they end up in Macs, I don't think Apple's going to allow that to run. They want you to run their operating system. So it's going to kind of make computer hardware more of a single purpose type of device. That's my fear. Because now you've got the CPU design itself in the hands, you know, of the companies that actually manufacture the devices. The other concern I have is actually about ARM itself and potential competition. I mean, I don't think anytime soon x86 is going to go away, but I think after this big push into ARM chips for consumers with laptops, desktops, really starts kind of gaining momentum, I think what we're going to see is that x86 chips will end up in a position kind of like how PowerPC ended up, where, yeah, they're still available for like embedded devices and the companies that move a bit more slowly that produce, you know, integrated types of systems. Think something like smart speakers. But I mean, obviously, if it's an Intel chip, it's going to be a more like industrial piece of equipment. You know, those industries are very slow moving. It's going to take them even longer to like rewrite their software to work on a different CPU architecture. So for them, I mean, I think Intel is going to stick around. But for everyone else, we're going to move to ARM more quickly. But that puts Intel and AMD kind of off into a corner by themselves. So ARM is going to be just it, right? And ARM is one company. And it controls, like I said, the architecture of the platform, but it also controls the licensing. Those who complain about how Intel is like a de facto monopoly, those people need to be even more concerned about ARM. Because now you suddenly got one company that's kind of at the root of computing at an even broader sense. Right? Like if you were to build a tablet today, you actually have some choice. You could put an Intel chip in it if you wanted, and some of the earliest tablets did. Or you could go ARM. But if ARM is really kind of the way everyone goes because x86 has hit this performance wall and can't really progress any further, well, now you're at the mercy of a single company as opposed to before where at least you had Intel and AMD to pick between. And there was competition, even though their licensing agreement between AMD and Intel is really weird. There's still competition between those two. And, you know, competition, of course, is always good. And standardization of technology is a huge component in that. I mean, like, while I like and I'm excited to see where things go with ARM chips, I mean, I think this is a transition that we've needed for quite a while. I also don't necessarily want to see AMD or Intel just fade away from the CPU market. I mean, AMD obviously has its graphics chipsets to fall back on. Intel has been doing like a bunch of integrated and embedded types of chip kind of things for a while. They've also open themselves up as a fab for other companies. So Intel owns its own factories. It doesn't outsource production of its CPUs to another company. And it's been opening up, you know, taking on jobs for other people who want to make chips in its fab. So I think even if either of them get away from doing CPUs, they're both going to be fine, even though they'll shrink in size as companies. But I don't even want to see either of them go away from the CPU market. What I want to see to foster competition is I want to see both of them work on like a brand new RISC-based CPU architecture. Don't bring any of their legacy designs forward. Don't reuse any old work. Don't just like derive off of what an ARM chip does. Don't like license. Don't be another licensee of ARM technology. Like, go back to the drawing board and start fresh. If you were going to design a brand new CPU, knowing everywhere that we've been with CPUs, but not wanting to carry on any of the baggage that we've had to deal with in the past, what would you build? Put teams at both companies to work on that. That's what I would want to see. Both companies would still end up with competing each other and maybe set up another license agreement between the two of them so they can kind of share their work, share their designs, but still iterate on them independently. And that would get them to compete so that they independently or collectively wouldn't stagnate. But they'd also have that competition with ARM. So you've got like a double competition thing going on there, which would be really interesting. But also get AMD and Intel to stay compatible with each other. Kind of like how it is now. You know what I mean? That way, if they both do it right, we'll all benefit from a CPU design, at least one CPU design, an alternative CPU design that could be good for the next 40 years. Thanks for listening.